Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce cost and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/strange. 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 I'm Laura Norton, and this is One Strange Thing, the show where we search the nation's news archives for stories that can't quite be explained. Today we visit Columbia County, Pennsylvania, tucked into the northeastern quarter of that pleasantly rectangular state. Columbia County is pretty rural. There's farmland and there's game land and some towns that popped up along the Susquehanna River. And in the southern tip of the county, there's mining country. Our story today concerns a Columbia County mining town, Centralia. Several decades ago, it was home to about 1,000 people. But in 2020, the last time that the Census Bureau was out there were 5 residents. It's now a ghost town, and there's a very good reason for that. You see, underneath Centralia, a fire is raging. And that's not a metaphor. It's literally on fire down there. To explain why that's the case, though, we do need to go back in time, to the heyday of Centralia's coal mining endeavors. According to CentraliaPA.org, a site devoted to the town's history, the first 2 mines in Centralia opened in 1856. In 1890, the town would reach its highest population numbers ever, a little less than 3,000 people. There were 7 churches in town and 27 saloons, which is a fun ratio if we've ever heard of one. But in the intervening decades, the United States got involved in a world war, diverting Centralia's young mining men away to military service. And the stock market crash that sparked the Great Depression caused Centralia's main employer, Lehigh Valley Coal Company, to shutter 5 of its mines. Despite that, though, mining operations, they actually hung in there throughout the 20th century and even into the 21st. As a matter of fact, there are still miners in Columbia County. They're just not in the mine that we're concerned with, which is good because it's on fire. Now, how this mine shaft became on fire is the topic of some debate among local historians, and we will get into that. What we can tell you for certain is this. The city dump just outside Centralia borough limits caught fire in May of 1962. Because that dump was located in an abandoned strip mine pit, and because something somewhere had not been sealed off correctly, the fire entered mining tunnels. The debate here is more about the order of events. According to the Inquirer, in May of 1962, Centralia's borough council decided it was time to empty out the city dump. So, local firefighters lit the dump on fire and just let it burn, such that the volume of trash decreased into a smaller pile of ash. Strangers, this might sound like a downright primitive method of waste management, but it wasn't actually uncommon in the mid-century. Residential homes sometimes had their own incinerators, and cities would often burn trash as a matter of course. It actually still happens today. Other sources, though, they're not so sure of the Inquirer's narrative of the story. And officially, The start of the fire remains a mystery. It's possible that it wasn't set on purpose. Maybe someone out there dumped hot coals, for instance. But regardless of how or why the fire started, the result was the same. This pit full of trash caught fire, and because this pit had formerly been part of a mining network, the fire spread underground. Now, how is that possible, given that underground is rocks? Well, strangers, we've been reading up on geology, and the short answer is that rocks don't burn, but coal does. And being that these mines were rich with veins of coal, that was what was catching on fire. And it does sound bad. But according to the Associated Press, it was not an immediate death sentence for Centralia. It just required that local officials act fast. But that didn't happen. Quote, "The fire began at the town dump and ignited an exposed coal vein. It could have been extinguished for thousands of dollars then, but a series of bureaucratic half-measures and a lack of funding allowed the fire to grow into a voracious monster, feeding on millions of tons of slow-burning anthracite coal in the abandoned network of mines beneath the town." The Republican and Herald wrote that 2 months after the fire started, the State Bureau of Mines became involved. Because while mining fires weren't in and of themselves unusual, this one's fumes were beginning to snake into active mine shafts in Centralia. As the paper wrote, quote, "By August, the situation deteriorated to the point that 23 mines were ordered closed and 140 men were jobless. And that situation would continue to deteriorate." But the media machine didn't seem to take much note in the years after the fire began, or really any note. We found basically no mentions of this evolving disaster in our newspaper archives, which is interesting, because there were glowing stories about landfill management in Columbia County and stories about other mine pits being filled in. But those articles didn't even mention this fire of interest. Strangers, if you're wondering why it seemed so easy to ignore the looming disaster in Centralia, don't worry, because we wonder that too. As we said, there are basically no mentions of this fire in our archives. We didn't find a thorough article until 1974, more than 10 years after the fire started. And that's a concerning gap for any major event, let alone one that was actively spewing toxic chemicals into the air. But there are a few reasons why it makes sense, at least on some level. For one thing, as we've mentioned, mine fires were pretty common, and it apparently wasn't uncommon to just let them go, so long as nobody was in active danger. For another thing, we're talking about a rural part of the state, pretty far away from big papers and population centers. So it was easier, especially in the pre-internet era, for a small town suffering to slip through the cracks. But it wasn't going to be possible forever. Have you ever wondered what it feels like to be attacked by an alligator? Or what goes through one's mind as they're stranded in a snowstorm? What Was That Like is the podcast for you. Real people come on every episode to explain the unbelievable situations they've been through. Guests share how they really felt during their most surreal experiences. They tell us what they did the morning before an earthquake, how it feels to win The Price is Right, and all sorts of details that you'd never learn anywhere else. If you're interested in hearing disturbing and inspiring firsthand stories, What Was That Like is the podcast you've been looking for. Every story is thoroughly researched and fact-checked, so you know that even the most unrealistic are someone's reality. Listen to What Was That Like wherever you get your podcasts.
Looking for creepy stories? Then we might have a podcast for you.
And now, presenting Rattled and Shook.
Rattled and Shook is a weekly podcast that features new scary stories every episode, kind of like this.
I would hear her say things to me inside my head.
I couldn't get around him. I was trapped.
The other guy started to get pretty agitated. He grabbed my grandfather's oxygen hose and he cut off his oxygen.
then I started thinking, well, you know, who would be hanging around in this nowhere forest, in this nowhere area? And that's when I started looking more closely. And that's when I noticed there were several shapes. And they were slowly working their way toward me as they were moving from tree to tree.
New episodes of Rattled and Shook are out every Thursday. Listen for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
From the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions, you have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle, and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75-degree angle straight down, almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do not go any further. Turn around, go home.
According to the Associated Press, it did seem like denial was a coping strategy in Centralia, at least for a while. Quote, "At first, most Centralians ignored the fire. Some denied its existence, choosing to disregard the threat." That changed in the 1970s, when carbon monoxide began entering homes and sickening people. In 1977, the Wall Street Journal sent a reporter to Centralia, and by that time, the situation was dire. Quote, "Deep inside Locust Mountain is an inferno that is steadily consuming a thick bed of anthracite coal at temperatures up to 2,000 degrees. Centralians can't see the fire, which is raging several hundred feet below the surface. But there are daily reminders that it's there." As the Journal reported, the fire had spread to span about 60 acres underneath Centralia and out to the east. And it was creating hazards that were pretty clearly not good to be around. That's the scientific term, we think. Anyway, quote, "As the fire burns, it spews up smoke and hot poisonous vapors through fissures and other openings in the ground, forming clouds and pillars of steam along the town's eastern edge." The state government and the Bureau of Mines had stepped in and attempted to put out the fire, but to no avail. The Wall Street Journal cites a decision made, quote, "a few years ago," remember, this was 1977, "to contain the fire, rather than to just put it out, because that had proven impossible." Thousands of gallons of water and sand had been pumped underground to no avail. The new plan was to pump tons of fly ash, which is the toxic residue left over from burning coal, into the mine tunnels below the city. Fly ash is fireproof, so the idea was that the fire would hit these walls of ash and not spread any further, and eventually die out. But Centralians were worried that this too wouldn't work. And the Bureau of Mines was certainly not doing a great job reassuring everyone that this was all going to turn out fine. Per the Journal, quote, "The Bureau of Mines says it's possible, although unlikely, that the town might have to be evacuated. Townspeople worry particularly about carbon monoxide, the lethal gas produced by the burning coal. Others are concerned about their homes catching fire." Maybe most upsettingly, the Associated Press wrote in 1977 that this wasn't even a once-in-a-lifetime event. As a matter of fact, this was just, quote, "one of seven major underground mine fires in the state that spew smoke and hot poisonous vapors into the air." The problem in Centralia was that there were still more than 1,000 people living directly above the blaze. And soon, poisoned air wasn't the only concern. The earth itself was becoming unstable. According to the Associated Press, this was the event that convinced the town that the fire couldn't just be willed away. Quote, "The beginning of the end came in 1981, when a cave-in sucked a 12-year-old boy into a hot, gaseous void, nearly killing him. Thankfully, the boy, he did survive. But because of that incident, townsfolk had to finally grapple with the pressing question of whether to leave. And if so, where to go? The Philadelphia Inquirer spoke with one resident named David Lamb, who was said to live, quote, next to the gas station in town. Per the Inquirer, quote, Lamb, 34, owner of a motorcycle shop here, has personal cause for concern. A fresh, vapor-spouting hole, 10 inches wide, opened up like an abscess in the corner of his yard just before Thanksgiving. Lamb feels trapped in the large white house he bought last March, a house that he thought was a safe distance from the fire. I can't move out. Who's going to buy it? He said, angry but uncertain of whom to blame. And the Inquirer also wrote about a widow, Marion Laughlin, whose chrysanthemums and her daughter's pet canary were killed by the carbon monoxide fumes wafting through the town. A couple, Rosalind and Martin Kranzel, they'd bought a three-story home in the eastern part of town back in 1976, and they were told it was safe. They, quote, had no trouble getting a mortgage. But soon after they moved in, government officials started drilling vents and monitoring toxic fumes from their yard. And according to the Daily Item, a resident named Eva Moran, the owner of a local candy store, she put it succinctly. I don't think people want to pick up their roots and leave here. Where would they go? Eventually, though, Centralian's hands were all but forced. Per the AP, the federal government secured $42 million to buy out Centralia residents and demolish their homes. The initiatives began in 1983, and by 1990, the 1,000-odd people living in town had dwindled to only 63 residents. Penn State University Press reported that some of the expats, they built a new community about 7 miles from Centralia. But others, they went farther away, some clear across the country. In 1992, Pennsylvania's governor tried to force out the remaining residents with evictions, condemnations, and eminent domain claims. Per the AP, those tactics were still in use in 2010 to usher out the residents who insisted that they weren't in danger. And as we said, by 2020, there are only 5 reported residents remaining in the town. It is a tragic story, strangers, and a testament to the possible dangers of industry sharing space with residential life. In that way, it's a story that you've probably seen before, maybe recently. Toxic waste in water, lead in pipes, smog in the air, microplastics in everything. Probably best not to think too hard about that one. But anyway, we understand why you'd see Centralia as a cautionary tale about meddling with the earth beneath our feet. It's a sad story, and a strange one, but in a different way than our usual fare. And it would be different. Except for one strange thing. There is a curse involved here, strangers. We're honestly surprised that we managed to keep that secret this whole time. Not that we didn't have enough geology to occupy ourselves. Now, as with all good curses, we need to go back in time for this to make any sense. So journey with us, if you will, back to May of 1876. In Pennsylvania still, but for reasons we assume are related to the weird news cycles of the 19th century, we're now in the pages of the San Francisco Call. There, we get a fantastic overview of the Molly Maguires. The Molly Maguires, often referred to as the Mollies, began as an organization in Ireland. Their mission was, basically, to enact vigilante justice against landlords. The Mollies made their way stateside in the 1860s, and per the Call, quote, they organized in Schuylkill, Carbon, and Columbia counties, and other coal districts of Pennsylvania. They were not satisfied with the wage scale that existed or with the way a mine superintendent ran his business. They objected to the way certain men did their work. As a rule, they comprised a cold, cruel, selfish body of men who, unable to have things done as they wished, took it upon themselves to correct existing conditions. The San Francisco Call article was an exposé about various crimes, mostly murders, that the Mollies had committed in Pennsylvania as part of the correction campaign. The call sources claim that the Molly's body count might have been upwards of 30,000 people, which is an extraordinary claim, and one that modern historians, they take issue with. And actually, modern historians seem divided on the issue of whether the Mollies existed in anything close to the organized fashion that the call wrote about. According to WTIF, there was a campaign to hang Molly Maguires in Pennsylvania's coal country in the late 1870s. But there's a catch. Quote, "To this day, the guilt of the 20 Mollies executed between 1877 and 1879 is hard to discover." Long story short, strangers, coal barons did not take kindly to outsiders with concerns about the miners' rights. And some historians believe that it was business interest and anti-immigrant sentiment that led those Mollies to being hanged by the state of Pennsylvania. According to an article from Penn State, the government actually even admitted, a century later, that the warrants and executions had been a mistake. We share all of this supplemental myth and history so that our next myth concerning Centralia will make a little more sense. We'll start with what we know to be true. According to the Columbia County Historical Society, Alexander Ray, the founder of Centralia and superintendent of two local companies, was killed in October of 1868. Four men were arrested in connection with his murder, and of them, three were eventually hanged for it a decade later. It was widely reported that these men were Mollies. We found a few sources confirming the broad strokes of this story. None of them were contemporaneous, of course, because that would have been too convenient. But now we'll turn to an excerpt we found from a book called Slow Burn, which is a written and photographic history of Centralia. In it, the author and photographer Rene Jacobs documented the lives of Centralians past and present. And in the aftermath of Ray's death, anti-Molly sentiment was brewing in the town. Rene Jacobs wrote this, quote, "Legend has it that a priest once denounced the Mollies from his pulpit. Later, as he prayed in the cemetery, the angry Mollies returned and beat him. The priest managed to stagger back to the church, where he summoned all of his parishioners by ringing the church bell. When they arrived, he told them this, 'From that day forth, there would be a curse on the town of Centralia. The little mountain mining town, founded on a bed of coal, would burn forever.'" We would be remiss if we didn't ask some questions. Who were these angry Mollies, if not the ones who killed Alexander Ray? Why curse the whole town to a fiery demise based on the actions of a few? Can priests even do curses? We're sure that the good people of Centralia had similar questions. But according to Rene Jacobs, the story stuck nonetheless, and some people did believe that the town had been doomed to burn, somehow. To be fair, the initial cause of the fire remains at least slightly unclear. So there is room for a spiteful deity on the table, if you really want there to be. And the future of the town, that's also unclear, because according to the 2020 census, only one of its five residents was under the age of 18. Even so, and in spite of the stubborn human spirit, there will eventually be no more people living in the town. The land is simply inhospitable, and it probably will be, as long as that fire burns, and for some time after. On the other hand, consider this. The forces of nature that allow a fire to rage underground for decades, spewing poison into the air above, are the same ones that lead to fires eventually burning out, and to wind that clears the air. You can choose to believe that Centralia is cursed. You can choose to believe that it will eventually heal. You could even pick both if you like. We might not have hard proof of either, but hey, if you've learned anything by now from this show, it's that the perk of believing is you don't need it. We hope you'll join us next time for another real-life story from the fine print of America's local papers, from the lives of regular people, just like you and me, except for one strange thing. Strangers, I've released my first book, and it's available everywhere, now as an audiobook, hardcover, and ebook. I read the audio version myself. It's called Lay Them to Rest, and it's about John and Jane Doe's, my years-long experience following forensic experts around the country, and our efforts to solve the mystery of a cold case. One Strange Thing is an independently produced podcast. To support the show and hear more of the entirely true and enticingly peculiar, you now have three options to enjoy two extra bonus episodes a month. On Apple Premium and Supercast, you can get the bonus episodes delivered to your app of choice for just $2.99. And for two more dollars a month on Patreon, you'll get more fun extras. There you'll find ad-free early releases of our regular episodes, two full-length bonus episodes, monthly giveaways, blog posts, and occasional live streams, all for $5 a month. We hope you'll check out one of these options to support the show. There's a link in our show notes. And if you enjoy One Strange Thing, please take a moment to leave us a great rating or review on your favorite podcast app. It really helps.